I don't support breaking diplomatic relations with Israel. I don't support the closing of embassies. But this bloke is clearly an unacceptable representative so far as Australia is concerned, and he should be sent home.
That's Chris Sidoti, human rights lawyer and member of the United Nations Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory and Israel, having something to say about Hillel Neumann, Israel's ambassador to Australia. Neumann has been particularly busy in the aftermath of Israel's refusal to investigate any further the killing by the IDF of the Australian humanitarian worker Zomi Frankum and her colleagues in Gaza a couple of years ago. To discuss Neumann's role in Australia and recent political developments in Israel, we're joined by Iris Mackler, veteran Jerusalem correspondent for ABC and SBS. Iris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Hillel Neumann, ambassador to Australia. Who is he? How does he operate?
Hillel Neumann is a career diplomat, which, given his hard-going style, might surprise some people. You know, Israel and other places, of course, too, does send out political nominees. He's not apparently one of those. So he has been an ambassador many years ago, I think, in one of the stands, worked with the Inside Israel in the Foreign Policy Committee, and has come out here and comes out swinging, comes out fighting on every issue. And there have been a lot in his tenure only since February 2026.
When you say come out fighting, what do you mean?
I mean, he takes Israel's point of view and plays hardball with it. Chris Sidoti describes him as a wolf warrior, not a diplomat, more interested in serving his master's political masters back home than actually dealing with Australians. I don't know if that's a fair comment, but he has got an assertive style for a diplomat. And we could see that because just recently, within the last few days, when he was in Canberra and he was speaking to journalists as he left, you know, he wasn't pleased with how that had gone. And he said, well, what do you think we have to do, lynch people in the street in response to Australians not being happy about the World Central Kitchen, the findings in this case?
When he was talking to those journalists, he made the extraordinary claim that a court had cleared the IDF. Now, that was just bullshit, wasn't it?
It is not a court that's cleared the IDF at all. This was all sent, you know, many cases were sent for an investigation. This is more than 2 years after the events, don't forget, David. And what the military advocate general, basically the military's prosecutor, what they said was certain cases don't have to go any further, a few do, and the World Central Kitchen cases is amongst those that we don't think has to go any further. So there hasn't been a court looking at it, not even a military court, certainly not an independent civilian or judicial inquiry of any kind.
So he was over-egging the pudding there. And is that his style? I mean, is his role really as a spokesman for Israel to the Australian people, so that he's a more of a player than a diplomat?
Perhaps that's how he sees himself, because he one of the reasons that Chris Sidoti is calling for Hillel Neumann to be expelled or to be recalled back home is because he says that he's been interfering in internal Australian political matters. And what he was thinking of, I spoke to Chris Sidoti earlier today, and what he was thinking of was Hillel Neumann coming up to the ALP meeting earlier in
the
July,
conference.
The conference in July, and putting forward his views about the ALP, things that are being put as policy in the ALP vis-a-vis Israel-Palestine, and the Israeli ambassador is putting his two cents worth in there. And Chris Sidoti says that's inappropriate. He said if a Chinese ambassador were to do it, there'd be an uproar. But Israel-Palestine being what it is, you know, people do throw their two cents worth in on both sides quite a lot. Is that the job of the Israeli ambassador?
Is it such a problem?
Or is it such a problem?
I mean, we hear the ambassador speaking loud and clear for Israel. Isn't that isn't that a plus for us to know what Israel's thinking?
Well, that's one possible view, but Chris Sidoti's view, and he's the one calling for Hillel Neumann to go home, his view is that that's stepping over the line, that the ambassador's strong defence of his country at various points, the World Central Kitchen case, the ALP conference, the incident with the Gaza flotilla, where what Chris Sidoti says of Hillel Neumann is that it was too strong to be criticising those Australians who were on that flotilla. 11 of the 400 people on the flotilla were Australians. They came back and made certain allegations, and Sidoti says that what we heard from the ambassador was criticism of them and a suggestion that they were Hamas supporters, and he says that's inappropriate.
What does it take for the IDF to continue investigating one of their killings?
At this point, I'm not clear. If the military prosecutor says no more investigation, it would have to be some political, I guess, pressure to make them go any further.
So the political pressure from Australia, I mean, the World Central Kitchen cohort all killed, despite their humanitarian job that morning being clearly briefed to the IDF. IDF permission had been given for them to go in, et cetera, et cetera. They were killed. They were Australians, British?
Three Brits, an Australian, Canadian, Palestinian and a Pole.
Right.
I think American Palestinian.
And the three governments, Australia, Britain, Canada, have all protested the refusal to continue investigating. And that's not enough.
Well, it's very recent. It may be interesting to see what happens next, actually, because in Israeli military terms, the military, just in its internal military terms, the military says there's no evidence of intention. I mean, when you look at all the facts and you see the report of the Australian representative, Mark Biskin, a former member of the Air Force, sent out to investigate at the time, it's a very interesting read. You know, it came out in August 2024. I was reporting on this story then, but I didn't read his report at the time. I have read it now, so thank you for that. But yeah, it's an interesting read because it's a bit more nuanced. It's a bit more of a nuanced picture. And he is satisfied that there was no intentional killing. He's not satisfied that there was no... That's right, that there was not reckless or negligent.
I mean, intention is one element of the law, but the other one is reckless indifference.
That's right.
To the outcome.
That's exactly right. Yep. So what the Israeli military investigation seems to be saying is there was no intention, you know, actual intention, and therefore we'll close the case. Not therefore should we look at negligence or indifference,
but
recklessness.
But other cases, they are continuing to investigate. And, you know, what is it about them that compels Israel to keep investigating?
Those two cases, one, the case of the 5-year-old Hind Rajab, who was...
Oh, my God, that story.
That story, it's so painful.
Sitting in a car, on the telephone, begging for help.
Begging for help, you know, for hours, asking the operator, don't you live near me? Couldn't you come and get me? It's almost unbearable to listen to as a human being listening to a small child. Everyone else in the car killed. They finally do send two paramedics to try to save her, and in the end, she and the paramedics are found dead.
Yep.
So that is such an egregious case, as is the killing of the, I think, 15 paramedics in Rafah in the south. Also a case where there was a dispute as to the facts, and then now it is being investigated further and recommended for a prosecution. Interestingly, Chris Sidoti, the UN commission that he sits on, the inquiry into the occupied Palestinian territories, has done a report on both those two cases. So they're large enough for them to transcend every boundary. They were in the media all the time. Not that the World Central Kitchen wasn't, but I think they're so egregious that they must be investigated further.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Iris Mackler, veteran Jerusalem correspondent. We will turn our attention now to the political situation in Israel. Tell us about Gadi Eisenkot.
So Gadi Eisenkot is 65 years old, a little bit older than some of the other people in the race, former military chief of staff, former general, former military secretary to Ehud Barak, if you're going to go back in time in Israeli politics. And he has come out as the head of a party called Yashar Straight. And he seems to be currently the most popular alternative to Benjamin Netanyahu in Israeli politics. Bit of a surprise because there's other opposition parties, but he's come into the forefront. And within the last 2 months, it was always the Likud party in the lead and other parties behind. And now for the first time, Gadi Eisenkot's party is in the lead. That doesn't mean what it means in Australia, but it does mean if they're the largest party, then they have the first crack at
forming a government.
It doesn't mean that he could form a government by himself at all. It would have to be a coalition, as it would have to be for Netanyahu. But what we're seeing for the first time is another party inching in front of Netanyahu's Likud.
He doesn't sound like a peacenik.
No, he's not a peacenik. In fact, he's a centre-right politician. I think we discussed this once before, that the dividing line in Israel now is people who believe in democracy and the rule of law and the country's institutions, and those who don't believe in them or only pay lip service to them, in which category I'd now put Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, who I think, having watched his career for all these years, his own political survival is now more important than many of the country's institutions to him. So I don't think you would say that about Gadi Eisenkot. So even though he's not a peacenik, he does believe in the democratic institutions of the country.
And he would not come entangled with the far, 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 far right, Smotrich, etc., who keep Netanyahu afloat.
Yes, and who they've all started turning their big guns, including all their social media poison machine, as it's called. Everybody's turning it on Eisenkot, which is a sign, I think, of the fact that he is actually a danger to them. And that's how they see him. He is a real rival. There's something he hasn't got that charisma, certainly not the political experience, but nor the charisma that Netanyahu, well, at least had in his earlier days. But he does have that kind of straight shooter, straight talker. There's also the fact that he has lost a son and two nephews in the Gaza war, which to an Israeli public represents a patriotism that they respect.
You mentioned a moment ago alliances. It seems that he would have to form an alliance of other parties. And the question is being raised at the moment whether anyone can rule after these coming elections without an alliance with Arab parties. What would that mean for Israel?
Well, it has happened once before. Mansour Abbas leads the Southern Islamist Party, so-called. He's a most unusual politician and a most unusual man. You know, previously the Arab parties didn't agree to sit in government with Jewish-Israeli parties, even if they were part of the Knesset, the parliament itself. So he broke that rule and he sat with in a government for the short time that Netanyahu wasn't in power, that I think it was 15 months, 18 months that he wasn't in power.
Over the last how many years?
Yes, over the last 20 years.
20-something years, yes.
Yes, but in that short period, there was a government that depended on Mansour Abbas. And he's a very interesting politician. Now, could they sit with him again? Benjamin Netanyahu, who courts Mansour Abbas himself, has courted and perhaps even continues to court Mansour Abbas, was heard spitting about that the only way the opposition to him could survive or could maintain power, could get into power, is with the support of the Islamists. So you can see it's becoming a fault line in this upcoming election. Now just over 2 months away.
But do the Arab parties have policies that would radically change what Israel is currently about in the region? And would they have the leverage to actually change things?
I don't know how to answer that because not all of them would sit in government. So really you're talking, nor would anybody be prepared to sit with some of them. So none of the Israeli parties, the Jewish Israeli parties, might be prepared to sit with them. But we are seeing for the first time in this election suggestions that Jewish politicians will join one of the Arab parties, that Arab politicians might join a Jewish party in a more significant sense than they have in the past when there have been Druze politicians, but not actually Arab politicians. You know, Druze is a minority. They are Arabs, but it's a different game in Israeli politics because they serve in the Israeli military. So, you know, will this be a groundbreaking election? Well, it will be a groundbreaking election because it's a referendum on Benjamin Netanyahu after all his years in office and after October the 7th. But will it also be a groundbreaking election because it will introduce Arab politicians or indeed Arab parties into government, despite the fact that everybody is now saying it won't make any difference and, of course, they're unlikely to sit with them? But will that change once they actually have to get to number 61 and make the numbers work?
We're familiar enough in this country with political leaders promising not to form alliances, which suddenly become indispensable when it comes to governing.
Core and non-core promises, I believe they're called.
Ah, yes, I've forgotten about the non-core promises. Mm-hmm. Israel may be weary of Netanyahu, but is it weary of war? Is the electorate demanding peace or just a different leader?
I think the electorate is weary. It's weary because it's been fighting on the southern front in Gaza, on the northern front in Lebanon, in an international front against Iran, it was very costly in both senses, both for Iran and for Israel, these past two massive offensives. So I think the electorate is weary, but they also fear that things won't change necessarily and that they'll be fighting for a very long time to come.
Is that because they've accepted Netanyahu's argument that Israel is inevitably imperiled and must fight?
I think the impact of October the 7th on the Israeli public has been huge. It's driven the public to the right. Even people who believe in negotiations with the Palestinians were set back by the level of viciousness of the October the 7th attacks, their brutality. And so on that level, what you're seeing is a different electorate. I don't even think they need to hear Netanyahu's arguments to be fearful. I think they're fearful because of what they experienced. Netanyahu is a powerful, he's a powerful messenger of fear. That's absolutely true. And if there were other politicians in power, it might be different. You know, I have interviewed very impressive politicians who were also military leaders who are not from Netanyahu's party, who say that fear-mongering of his is actually antithetical to the whole idea of Zionism, which wasn't so fearful in its origins. So, you know, there are other views in the country, and I think that that's why this is a seminal election.
And you're going to be there to report it for us.
I am indeed.
Which we look forward to very much.
Me too.
Iris, thank you once again for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks so much.